from deep inside your radio.
Swung on. There's a high popper into short left field. Seth Smith running in, shielding his eyes, and makes the catch. Two out. Dodgers still have runners on first and second, and that'll bring up Manny Ramirez. Ramirez batting .333, and as Manny Ramirez right here cleans his cleats and sets to get into the batter's box, coming into our booth is the former Vice President of the United States, Dick Cheney. Mr. Vice President, welcome to Dodger Baseball.
Well, thank you very much, Vin. It's a pleasure to be here with you, to talk to the fans and to you about things that are happening into our country that, frankly, disturb me a little bit.
Mm-hmm. Well, as De La Rosa goes into the stretch, Ramirez sets in the box, De La Rosa winds, delivers on the outside corner. Strike one call. Wow. Mr. Vice President,
yes, sir.
You're disturbed about the release of the so-called torture memos?
Mm-hmm.
Was this really torture?
Well, Vin, as you know, the administration has chosen the memos to release. And we just feel, you know me, I feel everything should be out in the open. That's just the kind of guy I am.
De La Rosa scans the runners, comes back at Ramirez. Oh. Fastball just missed the inside corner. 1-1 to Manny Ramirez.
Wow.
So, Mr. Vice President, you feel that the administration has memos still unreleased that would make your practices look good by comparison?
Well, not by comparison, Vin. We were trying to keep the country safe. It's as if Dodger dogs were under attack and somebody was trying to poison America by tainting the Dodger dogs.
Oh, golly.
Anything you could do.
Fastball right down the middle. Got Ramirez swinging at it. Took a monster cut. Missed everything. 1-2 to Manny Ramirez. Two out. Two Dodgers on base. No score. Mr. Vice President, fastball swung on. Popped up into shallow left field, drifting foul, and goes into the stands.
Vin.
Still 1-2 to Manny Ramirez.
Yeah.
So you feel that there are memos or tapes
not
to
tapes.
Be released? That
No, not tapes, Vin. Those have been destroyed in pursuit of national security, and there's no reason to go looking for more of those.
Oh, sure.
But there are memos that...
Fastball just misses the outside corner. Still 1-2 to Manny Ramirez. De La Rosa's fastball clocks in at 97 miles an hour. Mr. Vice President, that's pretty fast.
Yes, it is, Vin. But what I think is faster is the...
Ramirez swings at a curveball, and it goes deep into right center field.
You know, speaking about curveballs, I think that's what the... Obama administration has been feeding the country, if not screwballs, Vin. We are not as safe as we were when I was in office and not talking to people in the media. And certainly, I'd rather be not talking to the media and be safer than be talking to the media and be less safe.
Sure.
I don't know about you.
Well, I don't know about me myself, but Ramirez flies out and strands two Dodgers on base.
Too bad
about
that.
As we get to the end of the top of the second, no score in the ball. Mr. Vice President, I know you'd love to stick around, but we got baseball to take care of, so thanks so much for coming by, and best of luck to you.
Thank you.
At the end of 1.5 innings, no score.
I would like to...
This is Le Show and news from outside the bubble. Most of the stories about the torture program this week didn't mention this little fact, and those that did had it in a footnote. But it really does seem to be the answer to the one question that most of us may have been asking this week. From the McClatchy newspapers, why we tortured. The Bush administration applied relentless pressure on interrogators to use harsh methods on detainees, in part to find evidence of cooperation between al-Qaeda and Saddam Hussein's regime, according to a former senior U.S. intelligence official and a former Army psychiatrist. Such information would have provided a foundation for one of President Bush's main arguments for invading Iraq. In fact, no evidence has ever been found of operational ties between bin Laden's terrorist network and Saddam's regime. The use of abusive interrogation, widely considered torture as part of Bush's quest for a rationale to invade Iraq, came to light as the Senate issued a major report tracing the origin of the abuses. A former U.S. intelligence official, senior U.S. intelligence official, familiar with the interrogation issue, said that Dick Cheney and former Defense Secretary Donald Rumsfeld demanded that the interrogators find evidence of al-Qaeda and Iraq collaboration. There were two reasons why these interrogations were so persistent and why extreme methods were used, the former senior intelligence official said on condition of anonymity. The main one is that everyone was worried about some kind of follow-up attack after 9/11. But for most of 2002 and 2003, Cheney and Rumsfeld especially were also demanding proof of the links between al-Qaeda and Iraq that former Iraqi exile leader Ahmad Chalabi had, and others had told them were there. It was during this period that CIA interrogators waterboarded two alleged top al-Qaeda detainees repeatedly, Abu Zubaydah 83 times in August 2002, Khalid Sheikh Mohammed 183 times in March 2003. There was constant pressure on the intelligence agencies and the interrogators to do whatever it took to get that information out of the detainees, he continued. They were told by Cheney's and Rumsfeld's people to push harder when they kept coming up empty. Cheney's and Rumsfeld's people were told repeatedly by CIA and by others that there wasn't any reliable intelligence that pointed to operational ties between bin Laden and Saddam, and that no such ties were likely because the two were fundamentally enemies. Senior administration officials, however, quote, blew that off and kept insisting we'd overlook something, that the interrogators weren't pushing hard enough, that there had to be something more we could do to get that information, unquote. A former U.S. Army psychiatrist, Major Charles Burney, told Army investigators in 2006 that Gitmo interrogators were under pressure, his word, to produce evidence of ties between al-Qaeda and Iraq. While we were there, a large part of the time we were focused on trying to establish a link between al-Qaeda and Iraq, and we were not successful in establishing that link, he said. The more frustrated people got in not being able to establish that link, there was more and more pressure to resort to measures that might produce more immediate results. News from outside the bubble, ladies and gentlemen, a copyrighted feature of this broadcast. This is the show, and New Orleans haters can tune out now because this is a show for and about New Orleans lovers, and a relatively new addition to the list, I think, is with me via the magic of radio in Boulder, Colorado, the author of a relatively new book, Nine Lives, Death and Life in New Orleans, partnered with his wife, Margaret Knox, Dan Baum. Dan, welcome.
Thank you very much.
First of all, I love the book. It's remarkable in any way that I can understand books to be remarkable. But I have to ask you, why did you decide to put death in front of life in the subtitle?
I didn't. That was the decision of my editor. I was arguing for no subtitle.
But no,
it turns
course.
Out all nonfiction book writers say no subtitle. They say Midnight in the Garden of Good and Evil didn't have a subtitle. But it turns out In Cold Blood did have a subtitle.
Which was
a surprise to me. A small town murder and its aftermath.
Hmm. All right.
And so,
well, that would have been good for this book. You can't copyright a subtitle.
Can't copyright a title. That's right. They came up with that, and I thought, well, it sounded pretty good. It's counterintuitive. It makes you stop, and I hadn't seen those words in that order before.
Well, the reason
there's
I
plenty
ask
about
is,
there's plenty about death in the book. So
yeah, but much more about life.
There is much more about life in the book. That's true. But life and death in New Orleans, it would have sounded like, I don't know, a
reality show.
It would have been dull.
Okay. Well, I just want to stipulate that there's much more about life in this book. You came to New Orleans in probably the most dire of circumstances for coming to love the town. Describe a little bit about it.
Yeah, I had never really seen New Orleans until it was full of water. Mm. I had been there a couple of times before, maybe for one night, fly in, interview somebody, and fly out. What happened was I have a friend here in Boulder from Baton Rouge, and on August 28th, 2005, I ran into her and she said, "Did you hear they're evacuating New Orleans?" So I immediately called my editor at The New Yorker and said, my God, they're evacuating New Orleans. I ought to get down there. And he called David Remnick, who's the editor of The New Yorker, and the word came back that, oh, they always evacuate the city and nothing ever happens. And, you know, relax, for God's sake. And then, of course, Monday it was, you know, after the levees broke, it was, you know, you got to get there as fast as you can. So I couldn't get there until Wednesday, which was 2 days after the levees
broke. Well, you got there. That's 4 days faster than the feds got there.
That's true.
You might want to explain how you got there.
It was, well, I flew to Baton Rouge and rented the last car, went to Walmart in the middle of the night and loaded up with, you know, food and first aid and water and jerry cans for gasoline, and saw an enormous knife fight in the Walmart in Baton Rouge at about 2 o'clock in the morning. Baton Rouge was full of people totally freaked out, as you can imagine. Mm-hmm. I mean, a lot of people didn't have a place to stay, so they were just kind of circulating around town in their cars. And I went into this Walmart, and it was jammed with people buying stuff. And these two enormous guys got into a knife fight. I mean, there was blood everywhere. There was blood splattered all over the products on the shelves, and it was horrific. And then I at dawn started down, and it was hard getting into the city because the roadblocks were there, mm-hmm. and I had this cheesy little press card that I had made myself and laminated with the little, you know, luggage tag laminators, tried to make it look as official as possible. And it took me two or three roadblocks to find one that would let me through. And I just kind of fell in with a bunch of emergency vehicles and kept my flashers going and tried to make myself look like, you know, the federal response.
Except that you were there.
Yeah, exactly. The difference being that I was there.
Yeah,
and I'm kind of a puss as a reporter. I mean, there are my wife Margaret. She loves war reporting, and but I don't. I'm kind of a puss, and I was scared to death. I got to tell you the truth. And I came over the Mississippi River Bridge into the city, and the streets are just full of totally wigged out people, very scary looking people, and I realized, somebody's going to hijack me for my car so they can get out of the city. So I just drove it all the way uptown. I kind of instinctively went uptown to where all the nice big houses were and just hid the car. It was a van behind a house, kind of put some fallen branches over it, make it look like it was trashed, and then walked back downtown and started using a bicycle to get around town because – I don't know. I was just afraid to be driving around with this nice big van. I was afraid people would take it. And as you say, you know, it was another 4 days or 3 days until anybody showed up, and it was so spooky that there was no response. That, like, in the middle of the second day or maybe the third day, I called my editor because my cell phone still worked. It wasn't a 504 cell phone, so it worked. And I said, did something else happen? And I thought maybe, you know, an atomic bomb had gone off in San Francisco. I mean, it was – you couldn't understand where was everybody? Where was everybody? It was just spooky. And then, you know, they showed up. And I got to tell you, Harry, I've been a reporter for 25, 26 years. I got the single stupidest answer to a question that I've ever gotten in New Orleans. And it was really kind of a high moment for me as a reporter. I went out to the FEMA operation, which was operating out of the Saints training facility right outside of the city. Mm-hmm. And they could land all their helicopters on the gridiron. And at that point, this was maybe, I don't know, a week into the crisis. The big problem in the city was that a lot of people weren't leaving. You know, there's a lot of people, as you know, there's a lot of people in New Orleans who've never been out of the city. Mm-hmm. They've never met anybody from outside of the city. They have no idea what's outside of the city. And nobody was telling them where they would be taken, what would happen to them, how long they would be gone. And so people were just frozen in panic. And it was becoming a real public health and safety problem. I mean, the right thing to do was to get everybody out of the city. That was the right thing, and they were trying to do that, but people weren't going. And so they were having to go house to house and take people out of their house at gunpoint and in handcuffs. It was really ugly. And so I went out to the FEMA place, and I asked the guy, why don't you send somebody to Kinko's and make up some leaflets and leaflet the city? Drop a bunch of leaflets and say, look, here's where you're likely to go. Here's what you should bring. Here's why you've got to go. There's no electricity. There's not going to be any drinkable water in the city.
Here's how long it'll be before you get to come back.
Exactly.
Yeah. Which was the question on a lot of people's minds.
Right. How long will this take? And just, tell people what's going on. And the guy said, oh, man, have you seen the city? We wouldn't want to add to the litter. And I put my hand out and I said, shake my hand, sir. I've been a reporter a long time. That's the stupidest thing anybody's ever said to me.
You really did. Well, you're not that much of a puss. You're a big 6'3" tall puss is what you are.
This poor guy, he'd been brought in from God knows where. And, and the truth is, they wouldn't have known what to put on the leaflets because they didn't know where people were going to go and they didn't know how long they'd be gone and they didn't know what people should take.
Yeah. And they didn't know what Kinko's was.
And they probably didn't know what Kinko's was. It was an amazing though we do have to say, let's just take a moment here and give credit to the Coast Guard.
Oh, my God, yes.
The Coast Guard had 8 little helicopters over the city as soon as the winds got below 50 miles an hour. And so they were there from the very first doing a fabulous job. So it would be – I don't want to tar the whole federal government with the same broad brush. Everybody but the Coast Guard was stupid.
Yeah. Well, the Coast Guard was amazing because they didn't wait for anybody to tell them what to do. They just did what they saw.
Well, that is the nature of the Coast Guard. Yeah. That's how the Coast Guard works.
You got to know the city in its moment, as Disney would put it, New Orleans underwater adventure. And for some reason, you decided there was more here that needed to be told. So how did this book get to...
Probably my first inkling that was on my very first day. I was all the way uptown, kind of hiding from the from what, we had been hearing. There was all this terrible violence, and it turned out there really wasn't. That was all kind of a calumny.
Spread in part by the mayor and the police chief.
Exactly.
Oprah.
But I was all the way uptown. I think I had just dropped off the car, and I met this family, this man with 2 little girls, dipping water out of the Mississippi River so he could flush his toilet. And this is up, way uptown and kind of a funky part of uptown. And he started going on about how they had blown the levees and, now that they got all these poor black people out of the city, they're not going to let them back. And this whole thing that, became the refrain for the following year and beyond. And I remember thinking, man, this poor guy, he doesn't have anything to eat, doesn't have any drinking water. He's got these 2 little girls. He has no way to get out of the city. He has more important things to think about right now than spinning some kind of racial conspiracy theory about this thing. But it turned out that what he was talking about set the tone for the whole year and a half to 2 years that followed, and prevented a lot of good things from happening, probably prevented a lot of bad things from happening. And that was my first inkling that there was going to be more to write about here than just, water and levees and, your basic disaster thing. I've covered disasters before, and there's a template that you go through.
Mm-hmm.
This was my first thinking that, there's going to be some really interesting stuff happening here. And then there was another moment that I remember. Joe Braun of the Jazz Vipers, the saxophone player?
Yes.
This was maybe 2 weeks into the thing, and I ran into him. I was introduced to him and ran into him, and I had just heard that day that all of the city's real estate records had been in a basement and flooded and were destroyed. And I, not being from New Orleans, interpreted that as bad news. Oh, my God. Now how are people going to prove what they own and how they're going to get aid and how they're going to make insurance claims and all that? And I ran into Joe and I told him that. And he said, oh, thank God. And what he meant was, thank God, now nothing can change. nobody can sell their house. No big real estate interests can come in and buy up the Lower Ninth Ward and turn it into an industrial park. Nothing can change.
So that's why the Trump building hasn't gone up yet.
That may be one of the reasons.
Yeah.
But that's a very New Orleans thing. Mm-hmm, just this intense desire that absolutely nothing should change.
Yeah.
So, you cover this disaster, and as I've said, when you cover something like this, there's this template that you go through, and you got to get this, and you got to get this. And then there was, in the Reconstruction, you know, there was this commission, that commission, the governor this, the mayor that, FEMA this, the National Guard that. You know, all this stuff that I had to write about for the New Yorker about the recovery. And I kept getting the sense that I couldn't get to the stuff I really wanted to write about, which was how freaking weird New Orleans is, you know, how different from any place else I've ever been. You know, it's certainly not like the rest of the United States. It's kind of more like Mexico, where I used to live. It's just weird and mm-hmm. different. And that's what I wanted to write about. But by the time I would fill up all my inches with this commission, that commission, the mayor this, the governor that, there was no room left for the good stuff. And I kept begging for more inches in the magazine. You know, let me do one more story. Come on, coach, put me in. Let me do one more story about the really cool stuff that there is to say about this amazing city. And by that time, the magazine's appetite for New Orleans was satiated. I was told Katrina is over.
Mm-hmm.
So you can tell your friends in New Orleans, Harry, that word from the top, Katrina's over.
Okay, if the New York, if the New Yorker says it, it's got to be true.
Yeah, that's right. And you know, and so I never got to write about the good stuff in the magazine, and that's why this is a long, very long answer to your question: why do we want to write this book? That's why we wanted to write this book.
Well, you're saving me, you know, the effort of thinking up so many more questions. So you and I have shared one really remarkable advantage, it seems to me, in getting to know New Orleans.
Being Jewish guys.
Yeah, right. In our privileged position as sort of outsiders with access, we've been able to cross a lot of lines that New Orleanians might not. So it's clear from the variety of people and the variety of backgrounds that they represent that you've depicted in the book, that you've been able to cross all these racial and economic lines and have access to the plenitude of New Orleans society. You have it goes all the way from the King of Rex, which is the premier Mardi Gras parading organization in New Orleans, to Anthony, who I guess is kind of serially homeless in New
right,
Orleans.
Right, serially incarcerated.
He's serially incarcerated when he has a home. I mean, did it seem to you like you had this privilege of kind of going across lines that other people might not ever go across?
You know, I'm not sure. Well, it may be that they don't. I'm not sure that they can't.
Right, they don't, though.
Right,
I mean, Billy would never have encountered Anthony in any...
Exactly, which is
situation.
Why we did the book this way. You know, and I should say for the listeners who don't know the book, this is the intertwined life stories of these nine people. And they are very different from each other, as you say. And they don't, some of them intersect physically. They run into each other, but most of them don't, which is kind of a weird way to structure a book. I mean, most people want to write one story, you know, with a beginning, middle, and an end, and mm-hmm. a set of characters that you follow all the way through and that have to do with one another. And we looked for a long time, Margaret and I, for one story that would kind of wrap a rope around the city the way we wanted to. And we realized there really isn't one. I mean, you know, people who expect all nine of these people to end up on the same flooded rooftop will be disappointed mm-hmm. because, you know, as you say, Billy Grace, who is this Confederate gentry, wealthy white guy up on St. Charles Avenue, his life is not going to intersect that of Ronald Lewis in the Lower Ninth Ward or Anthony Wells in the Goose. So we decided we just have to do it this way. As for access, you know, New Orleans makes it really easy. People there, you know, the best thing about New Orleans, better than the music, better than the food, better than the architecture, is that nothing is none of your business. you can ask a total stranger the most intimate questions and, you know, far from getting socked on the jaw, you'll get a beer bought for you and a long-winded answer.
Mm-hmm.
You know, one of the people in my book begins the book as John Guidos, ends the book as Joanne Guidos. The story of her 50-year transformation from a man to a woman is, you know, told in detail so intimate as to border on the icky.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, until I met her during the crisis, she didn't know me from Adam. And here I am saying, here's what I want to do. I want to – I want to take an enormous amount of your time over the next few months to interview you and just take up hours and hours and hours of your time. And then I'm going to write down your whole story in intimate detail and put it in front of the entire world to read. And there is nothing in it for you. And the amazing thing about New Orleans is that all nine of these people said, okay, sure.
Yeah, sounds like a good deal to me.
Sounds like a good deal to me. And maybe that would happen in St. Louis or Dallas or Detroit. I don't know. I mean, I'll give myself some credit. I'm a good interviewer, right? Mm-hmm. Really, I think it's testament to the culture of New Orleans, where nothing is none of your business. I mean, you've had this happen, Harry. You're walking down the street and some person comes up to you. You've never seen her before. And she goes, hey, babe, I love them shoes. My auntie had shoes like those. And, you know, the next thing you know, you're hearing about her auntie's dog and the time they all went to Lafayette. And, you know, that's just how people there are.
Yeah.
You know, the city has always struck me as kind of one big cocktail party. You know, people get up in the morning and really what their day is about is just kind of lurching around the city, trying to find a more entertaining encounter than the last one they had. That I just love it. You know, and for somebody in my unseemly profession, it's just, you know, fabulous.
One of the things that comes through in this book is sort of an uncontrollable love of the city and of its nature that is never expressed, but is as I say, just pours through every pore of the writing. But another is you did get really close to these people, or they got to tell you great intimate gobs about themselves, and it's at one and the same time it's a resolutely unsentimental book and a profoundly moving book. I mean, were you trying to get to shape it so that there was like a puddle up moment at the end of almost every one of these chapters? Because you sure succeeded.
Oh, well, good. No, I don't know about a puddle up moment at the end of every chapter. There, we did have two principles that going in. One of them was no bad guys. When we started writing this, New Orleans had been beaten up plenty. There was already a backlash happening. Oh, those people down there, why should we send them so much money? Mm-hmm. They're just going to, you know, they're corrupt. They're going to squander it. You know, the city's at below sea level. It's just going to flood again. So there was this kind of resentment backlash happening against the city. So we wanted no bad guys. So, you know, George Bush is not in this book and Ray Nagin's not in this book.
Brownie's not in the book.
Brownie's not in the book. Not about that. So we wanted no bad guys, and we wanted all happy endings. And that was a conceit. That's an artifice. I mean, I could have ended any one of these nine stories at a down moment. Lord knows there are plenty of them. Mm-hmm. But we decided to end every one of these at an up moment, 'cause we feel good about the city. We love it. City's been beaten up a lot, and we just thought that's how we want people to finish reading this book, is feeling upbeat about it. So those were the only two kind of artificial principles that we had in telling the story. As for puddle-up moments, I mean, there's a lot of those in life in New Orleans, even well before the storm.
Well, I mean, there's this fabulous story about Wilbert Rollins, band director.
Yes. He's at O. Perry Walker High School over across the river in Algiers,
yeah.
Part of New Orleans.
And the story of him and his meeting his wife and separating from his wife and reuniting with his wife. It would be, you know, in a more conventional telling, probably the spine of a novel or of a book, but it's just full of puddle up moments, and yet
it's cool how the storm repairs that marriage. Destroys everything else and repairs that marriage.
Yeah,
I know
it's amazing.
I love that.
This is Le Show. We're talking with Dan Baum, author of the relatively new book, Nine Lives, Death and Life in New Orleans. There's one moment, and I only bring it up because I think it's fairly implanted in New Orleans lore. One of the characters or two of the characters in the book are Joyce and Tootie Montana. She is the wife. He is the legendary Mardi Gras Indian chief, universally recognized in New Orleans as the savior of the Mardi Gras Indian tradition.
Mm-hmm.
And
the inventor of the modern the modern suit. Yes. Yeah, and, yeah. Yes.
And there was an incident that's famous in New Orleans where the police came in and cracked down on a Mardi Gras Indian celebration. And there was a meeting in the city council chambers that Tootie Montana attended, he being one of the representatives of Mardi Gras Indians. And it is in the lore of the city, I believe. It certainly was, I heard it from a dozen different people at the time, that at that meeting, he said words to the effect of, "This has got to stop," meaning the police not understanding mm-hmm. the neighborhood traditions, and dropped dead after having said that. That isn't in the book. So that didn't happen?
It didn't happen.
Wow.
And anybody who watched television knows that didn't happen.
Mm.
He, because I watched the tape.
Of course.
The meeting was covered, and he drops dead right on camera.
Yeah.
And he never says, "This has got to stop."
Mm.
He gives a little impassioned speech
about
how the police need to leave the Indians alone, but this idea that he said, "This has got to stop." But only because I had that tape could I verify that.
Mm. But you know how many people believe that that really happened, right?
Yeah, and you've raised a very good point, Harry, about New Orleans and what's true and what is not. When I was writing about New Orleans for The New Yorker, and then, I wrote this daily blog
for four and a half months. Which was fabulous, and people can still access it, right, at newyorker.com?
Yes, or at danbaum.com.
Oh, cool. You get the hits.
Yes. I was the only fact-checked blogger in the history of the internet, and I was being fact-checked by the New Yorker fact-checkers. And so I was on the phone with them five or six times a day because I was writing every day. As I would tell them over and over again, New Orleans is not a fact-rich environment. So I would get these calls from these 24-year-old Barnard graduates on the fact-checking desk, and they'd say, "Now, how do we know, here on page six, how do we know that this Leroy is a bad ass?" And I'd have to say, everybody knows that. What is folklore and what is received fact in New Orleans, there really isn't. The difference doesn't matter very much. And I'll tell you, there was one really interesting moment when I was working on this book, and it's mentioned in the introduction. Frank Minyard, who is the parish coroner, was raised poor and became a very wealthy gynecologist in the 60s. And in 1967, had this crisis and decided he's got to pretty much renounce his wealth and serve the poor of New Orleans and runs for parish coroner. Now, this crisis, he told me, he's absolutely sure it happened in 1967 because he knows it was right after he sold the racehorse or the sailboat or something. He knows it was 1967. And he also knows that what set it off was listening to Peggy Lee sing "Is That All There Is?", which was not released until 1968. So I called Frank back and said, "We have a little bit of a problem. You say it's 1967. Peggy Lee couldn't be, right, because mm-hmm. the song wasn't out yet." And he said, "What can I tell you, Dan? I know it was 1967 because of this, of this, of this, and I know it was Peggy Lee." And in fact, he stood up behind his desk and sang it for me. At first I thought, well, this is a problem. And then I thought, no, this is an opportunity, and I'm going to write it the way Frank told me, right? So the way it is in the book, it happens in 1967, and it's Peggy Lee. Couldn't have happened that way. But this is the way that Frank explains his life to himself.
Mm-hmm.
And so I left it that way. And I say this in the introduction. And, these stories in this book are as true as I could tell them. These nine people told me their stories. I would go and do everything I could to verify it with other people who were there, with newspaper clippings. But at a certain point, when you're working in New Orleans, you've got to say, look, the important thing here is not necessarily what actually happened, but how people say it happened, because this is what builds that culture.
Yeah, because it's a city of stories.
It's a city of stories. And so when people talk about Tootie Montana saying "this has got to stop" and then dropping dead, that's important that people tell it that way. Now, if I hadn't had the videotape, I probably would have told it that way. In this case, I could, actually check facts.
Well, you say that you had this conceit of no bad guys, but there's something else that really struck me reading the book. As you say, there's been a drumbeat of backlash against New Orleans for quite a while, and a fairly stereotypical depiction of New Orleanians as, you know, waiting for a federal handout and lazy and blah, blah, blah. And yet, high and low, black and white, everything in between, all the characters in the book have moments, and they're not at the end, they're all the way through. There are moments that you cannot help but describe as heroic.
Right.
You know?
Right.
Ronald going to save his museum in the height of the flooding, you know, is just an unconsciously heroic moment, you know. This is a guy who's been collecting the artifacts of the black Mardi Gras experience, and because his wife wants room in the bedroom, it's shoved into his garage, and it becomes a museum. And it's full of unspectacular, unconscious, heroic moments. Whether they're successful or not, Joanne defending her bar when the cops come and basically steal all her weapons, which was a moment, you know, talk about New Orleans lore, among especially conservatives in New Orleans, and there are plenty, the confiscation of guns was a major, major issue in the first 2 years after the disaster.
Yes, and there was a lawsuit.
Yeah.
There have been books about it. I am both a gun owner and a hunter and also a ardent believer in very strict gun control. So I kind of see both sides of this. There is something creepy about the police going around in the middle of a very dangerous crisis when the police are manifestly unable to protect people and taking away people's guns.
Mm-hmm.
That's an interesting moment. You can debate that moment. I was glad to be able to show it happen.
Yeah, and I mean there are plenty of the controversies that have roiled New Orleans in the years since the disaster that are have a shaft of illumination on them in this book. The decision to close Charity Hospital and to shut down the basic mode of healthcare for the poor and the indigent and the working poor, which is still a raging controversy in the city.
Yep, there is still no replacement for it.
No, and the issue of housing and but it's not an issue book. It's a book about these people and I'm not a big novel reader, but I had at the end of this book the experience that I have when I finished a novel that I really love is, oh dang, I don't get to hang out with these people anymore.
You know, it's been kind of gratifying. I kind of obsessively track what bloggers are saying about the book, and a good quarter of them call it a novel. And that's fine with me.
Well, it's beautifully written, among other things. That must be Margaret's work, right?
That's entirely Margaret's work, yes. That's right. That's right. I am a married man, Harry. I know how to answer that question.
A married man asks it, and a married man answers it. Now, you've had great reviews and good reception, but it seems to me, and it's a fabulous book. It seems to me that in a way, the book has been the victim of its subject, in that it's just out a few weeks, but it's already sort of been relegated to the New Orleans memory hole in a way. Is that just me thinking that, or?
Jesus God, I hope you're not right about that.
No, I hope I'm not either. That's why we're talking about it.
It's in a second printing.
Okay, good, good, good.
You know,
only because I've told people about it, and the people I've told have heard about it first from me, which is embarrassing for me.
Huh.
Because I'm not on the front of any literary trend, you know.
I hope you're not right.
Me too.
I happen to think there is a New Orleans memory hole, but there is also out there a tremendous reservoir of goodwill toward New Orleans. And, I think what the book is going to have to fight against is the misconception that it is a quote-unquote Katrina book.
Mm-hmm.
Very little about
the book. It was surprised me knowing you while you were working on it, but never having read it until it came out, that well over two-thirds of the book takes place before the flood.
Right, right.
It's
Three quarters of the book. Yeah. Well, you know, Katrina is not the most interesting thing about New Orleans, mm-hmm. and that's the point of the book. And we tried to write it. One of the things we tried to do was to make it so that by the time Katrina shows up on about page 210, we were hoping that the reader will have forgotten it was coming.
Mm-hmm.
And we kind of wanted the reader to experience it as a horrifying surprise the way we all did, mm-hmm. so that by the time the hurricane is starting to show up, we wanted readers to say, oh, my God, no, not now, not while Wilbert's got this going on and Ronald's got this going on and Joyce is doing this and Joanna's doing that. You know, oh, I forgot. We got mm-hmm. that coming. You know, we wanted people so engrossed in these people's stories that they didn't need the hurricane to drag them along. You know, whether we were successful at that, I don't know.
Oh, you were.
That was the intent. You know, I also have to give some credit here to my editor, a guy named Christopher Jackson at Spiegel & Grau, and I'll tell you why. This book contains a lot of fictionalizing, I guess is the word. And it's kind of a dirty word in nonfiction circles because people get criticized all the time for fictionalizing nonfiction. You know, when I'm recreating scenes, this is all done in scene, and when I'm recreating a scene that happened in 1972, right, I wasn't there. How do I know what they were wearing? How do I know what the weather was like? How do I know what, you know, when he said, you know, I'm going to go get me a new car and put his beer on the bar, do I know he put his beer on the bar at that moment? Of mm-hmm. course not.
Mm-hmm.
So we had to do a lot of, you know, it's very cinematic, and it's all in scene. Now, when you do that kind of thing, you open yourself up to criticism that he couldn't have known this. You know, how he's putting thoughts in people's heads. He's making up details he couldn't know. Well, that's true. But I would do it.
In fairness, you didn't put any words in the mind of a dying head of the CIA. So
no, that's true. I'm ahead of Bob Woodward on that.
Mm-hmm.
But you know, I would be as careful as I could. You know, I would you know, my main source, and then I would try to talk to as many people who was there as I could, and then I know what was on the radio. Then I know what the city smells like. I know what the city looks like. I would go to the place where these things happen, and I would take pictures of it so I could look at them later while I was writing. I would try to make it as accurate as I could, but there is a certain amount of fictionalizing that you do. And my editor, Chris Jackson, knew right where the line was, like how far you could take that and not get in trouble.
Hmm.
Someday I'll show you the first draft of this book, which we fictionalized wildly. and, you know, it was great, right?
Mm.
But it was too much.
Over the line.
And Chris understood, you know, you're not going to get away with that. You know, one of the problems is the people who review nonfiction books tend to be nonfiction book writers. And all of us want to do this,
yeah,
right?
Yeah.
And if you do it too much, the person who's reviewing you gets jealous and says, ooh, you know, I wish I could have done that.
I don't get away with that.
I don't
that.
Get to do that. Yeah. Right? I don't get away with that, so I'm not going to let this guy get away with that.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So, and kind of the miracle is, and I really attribute this a lot to Chris Jackson, not a single reviewer dinged us
wow.
for fictionalizing. Not one. And it was the thing that we worried about the most.
Of
it
course.
Was the,
yeah.
You know, that was what they were going to nail us on. And not one did. And so I really owe him a debt of thanks. He was really good.
I think it's also because you write one of the characters in the voice of the character, Anthony Wells. The rest, you're writing third person, but you're a very close third person. You're a third person who's almost inside the skull of the person being
yes.
described. And so there's both an intimacy and a perceived authenticity that is pretty consistent throughout the book.
It was a very cool thing. The way I do my interviews is with a laptop open in my hands, and I can type as fast as anybody can talk. So what I end up with is these transcripts of our interviews, pretty much word-for-word transcripts of our interviews. And I often wouldn't see until later, because in the interview I would just be interviewing and typing, and I wouldn't see until later that people say things differently in different parts of town.
Oh, yeah.
For example, you know, downtown, people tend to say, we're going to meet there for 8 o'clock. Whereas Billy Gray's Uptown, he would say, we're going to meet there at 8 o'clock, more the way you or I would probably. But that 4-8 o'clock thing, and I didn't even notice that until I was reading my notes. And I realized, wow, look at this. Wilbert does that, and Ronald Lewis does that, and people who seem to live below Canal Street that, you know, use the preposition that way. So I would use the preposition that way when I was telling the story from Wilbert's, you know, Wilbert's story or Ronald. That's just one example. You know, sometimes I think that my most useful skill as a writer is just that I can type wicked fast.
It's the only thing I learned in high school. Seriously.
And it helps.
Yeah.
It helps.
You've come to know the city pretty damn well, I would say. Can you distinguish, I mean, New Orleans is, I think, unique among American cities, although it's similar to London in that almost every neighborhood has its own dialect. Can you distinguish a Sixth Ward accent from a Seventh Ward accent?
I don't think I can go that fine. Yeah. I can kind of tell uptown from downtown. You can kind of tell the way people describe the name of the city. I mean, you say New Orleans.
That's an uptown pronunciation.
Yes,
it?
Yeah. Yes, and that's a kind of an uptown pronunciation.
Yeah. New Orleans is the real uptown pronunciation.
You know, yeah, like that's how Cokie Roberts says it. If you ever hear Cokie Roberts, you know, she like makes it like eight syllables out of it. It's amazing.
And four of them are diphthongs. You
know? It's beautiful, really. Yeah. So I can hear, you know, little things like that, but I don't think I can go Sixth Ward, Seventh Ward. I wish I could.
Yeah. The perception of New Orleans around the country, and this is possibly political and possibly takes you out of your comfort zone in talking about the book. But now two successive American presidents have made promises to New Orleans that are in progress of being not kept. What's your feeling about why a disaster this profound happening to a city this special has fallen so quickly and so apparently irretrievably through the cracks?
Well, don't they all? You know, New York City still has a big hole in the ground.
I was going to say, you're talking like Gray Nagin now.
In a way.
You got that big hole in the ground. You haven't put that building in there yet?
Right. Yeah. And, that's a good point. You know, Ray Nagin has his faults, but that's a 17-square-block area in the middle of the richest city in the world. Mm-hmm. And they haven't gotten that going yet.
Yeah.
Whereas New Orleans looks pretty good. Mm-hmm. I think, compared to what it looked like when it was full of water or right after. We have short memories in the United States. We focus on the future. We don't think about the past. I mean, that's kind of our national strength and our national weakness. And
history is an insult.
Yeah. I mean, nobody thinks about the Yellowstone fires or the earthquake in San Francisco in 89. We pick ourselves up and dust ourselves off and go forward. New Orleans got forgotten, got beat up and left for dead. It was terrible. But in another sense, this is a complicated thing. New Orleans, as we've said, is not like any place else in the United States, and it has always held itself differently. I actually wrote a blog about this. Along North Rampart, just on the edge of the French Quarter, there are these lampposts, and they're old. They're very old, and they have medallions on each side, and each medallion represents a different era of the city. And the first one says French domination, and it's got the dates. And then the next one says Spanish domination. It's got the dates. The next one says Confederate domination with the dates. And the last one says American domination. As though saying, y'all, you're just visiting, right?
Mm-hmm.
That we're going to be here. Mm-hmm. And so New Orleans has always felt itself different from the United States. And it may be that after Katrina, the nation returned the favor.
Yep.
It may be that on a certain level, people thought, that's really not.
That's not us.
It's really not the United States. Not us anyway.
Yeah.
That may be it. There's also, it was not in the Bush's administration to rebuild the big blue dot on an otherwise red state map. No point in doing that. That was a pretty rotten administration in a lot of ways, incompetent and venal and vicious. And New Orleans certainly bore the brunt of that. Interestingly, public opinion turned against the Iraq War after Katrina.
Yeah.
And also there were right after the flood, a lot of big plans to make the city, quote, bigger and better. And the Urban Land Institute came down, and there was all these commissions, and we're gonna make this into an Afro-Caribbean Paris, and we're gonna have mixed income neighborhoods and light rail, and you know, we're gonna do all these wonderful things. And really, it was the people of New Orleans who said no to all that, and just flat out rejected it. Some people heard that as code for a city that is whiter. I think they also heard that as code for a city run by the dollar and the clock, the way the rest of the United States is, and said, no, we don't want it. You know, it ran up against that New Orleanian desire that nothing should ever change. Really, we just want to put the city back the way it was. It had faults, but we loved it, and we just want to put it back. And that's pretty much the way it's growing back now. So,
The good news is that New Orleans is coming back as New Orleans.
Right. Not as Disneyland. Remember, we always thought it was going to come back as Disneyland, and it did not.
Yeah.
And that's a victory.
Yeah. There's a wonderful story in one of your blogs that I've repeated to about 2,000 people who ask me, what's life like in New Orleans? And maybe you could tell it, even though it's not in the book and has nothing to do with the book, but I love the story. It's when you went to the Brooks Brothers store in the Canal Place.
I went down there. Brooks Brothers, you know, came back pretty quickly. It was right on Canal Street. And when we were there, and I guess this is in 07, I needed a shirt. And I remember this man was helping this old, he's probably 60, maybe a little older than I am. And he just kind of had this, you know, the way Eeyore talked, you know, just kind of, you know, he was polite, but just kind of dragging it out of him. And he just seemed kind of down. And I remember I was looking at two shirts and asking him which he liked better. And suddenly he said, yeah, I'm on some pretty good antidepressants now. And I turn around and he just goes into this long discourse, kind of lachrymose discourse about how his house in Lakeview had been completely annihilated when the levee broke and his family was scattered and all his things were gone. And, you know, and this was a guy who had insurance and some means, and he was going to recover financially. That wasn't the issue. But he said, you know, my family's been in New Orleans since my great-grandfather. And you know, it was – what was striking was not so much that he had a terrible Katrina story to tell, because everybody did. But just that in the middle of Brooks Brothers, he just felt like he had to unload it on the customer he happened – and the customer he happened to be helping at that moment. And, you know, if it had been somebody different, the other person would have gotten it. But that just was coming out of him at that moment, and he had to tell it. And if you recall, the city was full of that.
Oh yeah,
you know, and
well, a city that loves to tell its stories in the best of times had the most remarkable set of stories ever to tell. And
And I think I benefited from that doing this book. I think there was a certain sense in these people that I better tell my life story now, because who knows if I'm going to be here after the next hurricane season.
You've had the opportunity, I think you took the opportunity at a book signing appearance in New Orleans to see at least some of the people that you've profiled in this book. What was that like? And who showed up and who didn't?
Ronald showed up. Ronald Lewis showed up. He's the Lower Ninth Ward streetcar track repairman with the museum in his backyard. Wilbert and Belinda showed up. Wilbert's the band teacher. Belinda is the Lower Ninth Ward woman who had this kind of up-and-out ethic her whole life. And Tim Bruno, New Orleans police officer now living in Texas, drove all the way from Texas to be there. He's the guy who carries the body around in his car the entire day of the flood. I've seen Joanne. I've seen Joyce. I've spoken to Billy. I have not heard from Frank Minyard.
Yeah, the coroner.
And I can't find Anthony. And that really saddens me. I went up to the Goose. You know, the Goose is this probably really the worst part of New Orleans, and makes the Lower Ninth Ward look like Zurich. It's just a really rough, beat up part of town, flooded terribly. And I went up there looking for Anthony, and I found his cousin. And his cousin drove me over to Anthony's brother's house. And we drive up, and there are this house is, you know, barely put back together since the flood, and it's still got mud all over the side of it. And this is, you know, 3 years later, and these women are sitting out there, and I think I counted 9 Canadian Club bottles in the mud in what would be the front lawn. And the brother comes to the door, like the cousin, Donald, goes over and he says, Greg, drunk? And the women say, yeah, he's drunk in there. And Donald gets out of the car and he goes over and he kicks the side of the house three or four times. Greg, come out here. We'll go find Anthony. And Greg comes to the door. I see him behind the screen and he's kind of blinking. And Donald yells, where's Anthony at? And it's like the words hit Greg in the middle of his forehead and just knocked him straight back. It was like on the Lucy show when somebody just pivots on their heels and we hear him hit the floor. Ba-boom.
Wow.
You know, and Greg goes, damn it. Get back in the car and drive away.
Jeez.
And who knows? I don't know where Anthony is. And so I'd like to put out an APB. If anybody knows where Anthony Wells is, give me a call because I haven't even sent him a book.
Wow. And
but as for the other people, everybody had quibbles.
Yeah.
Everybody had quibbles, but mostly they're okay with it.
It must be a remarkable experience to have been one of those people and to see yourself profiled so in such
it's
fine grain.
It's a spooky thing. It happened to me once. A friend of mine years ago wrote a book, and he had a chapter in there about me. And he made me out to be a total hero. It was all very complimentary, but I didn't like it when I read it because I'm thinking, I don't dress like that, and I don't walk like that, and I don't talk like that. Well, it turns out I do, first of all. You know, and nobody ever sees themselves as others see them.
Yeah.
You know, and then I had to realize, well, it's his book. It's his telling of story. And what's amazing is that so far I haven't had any of these nine really – I mean, they have had quibbles. I won't say they haven't. Mm-hmm. And we're gonna make little changes in the paperback, minor changes. I haven't had anybody – get really irate. I certainly haven't had anybody sue me. And I have heard from the Forsythia lobby. I make a reference in the book to there being Forsythia, and I've heard from many, many people that there is no Forsythia in New Orleans. So you can be sure we're going to make that change.
Thank God.
Thank God.
Yeah.
Yes.
We were all on pins and needles about that. Well, Forsythia, notwithstanding, it's a remarkable book. And for anybody who wants to get a feeling of what New Orleans was and is really like, beneath all the political blather and all the stereotyping, I can't think of a better way than to read Nine Lives by Dan Baum. Dan, congratulations. I've been looking forward to it for a long time since I first started reading you and then got to meet you. It exceeded every one of my expectations.
Well, you are really kind, Harry. Thank you so much.
It's the truth. And it's a wonderful book, Nine Lives by Dan Baum. And thanks for sharing some time with us today.
Thank you.
That's going to conclude this week's edition of the show. The program returns next week at the same time over these same stations, NPR Worldwide, throughout Europe, the USN 440 cable system in Japan, around the world, through the facilities of the American Forces Network, up and down the east coast of North America via the shortwave giant WBCQ, the planet, on the mighty 104 in Berlin, available at Stitcher.com for your iPhone or other smartphone, I presume. Available as a free download to members at www.audible.com/LeShow. Available as a free podcast at kcrw.com. A tip of the LeShow chapeau to the San Diego, Pittsburgh, Hawaii, and Chicago desks, and to Pam Halstead, as well as the gang in Boulder for helping to make today's show possible. The show comes to you from Century of Progress Productions and originates through the facilities of KCRW Santa Monica, a community recognized around the world as the home of the homeless.